Welcome to the Afikra podcast. This is another episode of our book club. My name is Mikey Mhenna. With us is author May Al-Naqib, who was born in Kuwait and spent the first 6 years of her life in London, Edinburgh, and St. Louis, Missouri. She holds a PhD in English from Brown University and is an associate professor of English and comparative literature at Kuwait University. Her award-winning short story collection, The Hidden Light of Objects, came out in 2014. And today we're talking about her debut novel, An Unlasting Home, which came out in 2022. May, welcome to Afikra.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here.
I'm really excited too. I really wonder, what is it like being somebody who studied literature, you know, got your PhD in English literature? Did you know while you were going through that program that, like, oh yeah, eventually I'm going to start publishing books and start publishing novels and short stories? Was that in the cards in your mind's eye the entire time?
So for me, ever since I was a child, I knew I wanted to be a writer. I started writing at the age of, you know, I kept a diary, I think around the age of 9 or 10, and I was a voracious reader, you know, it felt like forever. And so when you read, eventually you figure out that writing is something that you can do too. And so I always knew that that was what I wanted to do. But growing up in Kuwait, especially at that time, you know, I came of age in the late 70s and 80s, there was no sense that you could write as a career. So the closest thing to that for me was to study literature. And so I went down this path of, you know, I got a BA here at Kuwait University in English literature, and then went on and completed my PhD, thinking somehow that studying literature would allow me to become a writer. But in fact, what happened is that it pushed me further and further away from that, because studying literature and writing about it and that academic work really takes up, it takes up all your energy and all your time, and it's a completely different animal. And so it wasn't until after I completed my PhD, came back, started working at Kuwait University, that I felt like I had the time and space to turn to writing. So it was, in fact, really a circuitous route coming to the thing that I always wanted to do. And the study of literature just took me away from that. So it's funny how that worked out. But yes, I always knew that I wanted to be a writer, and it just took me a while to get there.
Yeah. You know, I'm always, you know, part of my job is to read people's bios as I introduce them for this show. And I'm always taken back by the construction of mini biography. Yours, you know, right from the jump, the sort of declaration that the first 6 years of your life, you know, you spent in London, Edinburgh, and St. Louis. Why do you think that's an important thing to say, to mention? I mean, it's related to the book, obviously. But why do you think that's a very important thing to mention in sort of your story of self?
I think for me, it really is important for a couple of reasons, one of which has to do with language. So because I was, you know, months old when we left Kuwait, my first language was English. My mom's first language was also English, because my mom, like one of the characters in An Unlasting Home, grew up in India until she was around 10, 11 years old, and then her family moved back to Kuwait. So my mother's mother tongue was English and Hindi. My mother tongue was also English. And so it is important to my sense of who I am, but also who I am as a writer, that I have to kind of claim I claim English, you know, because it is the language that I learned first. I think the second element of writing in my mini bio that I am from all, or I have had my foot in all these different places from a very young age, is because I carry in me, I think, this sense of movement, the sense of cosmopolitanism, which I think is also an element of Kuwait and its own history. I don't think it's something that it keeps me outside of Kuwait or distances me from Kuwait, but quite the opposite, the sense that many of us here in Kuwait have this interesting kind of mixed, I don't want to use the word identity, but let's say mixed experience in different places. And so for me, I think that was those were really the two important reasons why I put that out there right at the start in the bio.
Yeah, what I love about your book, and we'll get into this more, is especially like featuring the connection to India, because especially those, I mean, the 20th century, the second half of the 20th century and the 21st century has largely been dominated by the West, sort of Europe and North America. And so the gaze towards the Middle East comes from that perspective. And it's sometimes easy to forget when you're taking that perspective, how much interchange and exchange there was in the Gulf from Kuwait all the way down to, you know, Qatar and all that stuff, and going down to Bahrain with India, and how many people's parents and grandparents grew up in India, and how many Indians, by today's definition, how many Indians grew up in the Gulf, you know, grandparents and great grandparents and stuff like that. I love that part of your story. Do you feel like other people forget that the way I forgot it?
I do think so. And I think that's in part, as you said, you know, just because of everything that happened in the 20th century, and, you know, the way literally maps were reorganized following World War I, World War II, the colonial history, all of that takes over this much older history, in a sense, a slower history and experience. And, you know, the crossing over of cultures and languages and food and music, and of course, brought together through trade, and the movement of across the ocean. And for me, in my novel, that trope of moving across the waters, the trope of water and oceans and the migratory experience, is something that I think comes from that earlier, slower history of Kuwait, of the region in general, and the link to India. And I think many, again, I can speak for Kuwait, but I know this is true of other Gulf countries as well, that the trade brought families to India, and then they lived there, you know, whether in Mumbai or Pune, like the character in my novel, and they had lives there, and they lived there for decades and grew up, and still today have some connections to India, and in part because of trade, but also in part because of preference. They moved their families. This is not a majority of people, but certainly there are a number of merchant families that had roots in India, and those close ties still resonate even today. Many people still continue to visit because of those connections that were established in that earlier period.
Can you fill in some of the history for me and for our listeners? So how much of this is related to the India connection? Let's focus on that for a second. How much of this is related to the British sort of colonial reach in both those places?
I think it precedes that. So the trade, you know, Kuwait was it was a port, and it was the trading routes that were established. I'm definitely not a historian, but my sense is that those trading routes were local, you know, those were built on local trading interests rather than the connection to India. I mean, the rupee was used. That was certainly because of the connection to India. I mean, the British shared connection. But I think that those routes, starting in Basra with the plantations that were owned, the date plantations that were owned by Kuwaiti families, and so building on that, beginning with that resource, and then moving downwards, had more to do with, you know, stopping for timber, for mangrove poles, and then collecting textiles in India and moving back up. I think that had less to do with British colonial ties or interests or connections than it did with local needs and trade interests, is my sense of things. Yeah.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about where the story of the book came from. And maybe what actually makes sense is, can you give a sort of a broad introduction to what the book is about? And then I want to talk about 2013 a little bit.
Sure. So An Unlasting Home is a multi-generational saga about, five really formidable women from the region. And the protagonist, Sara, who is the granddaughter of two of the main characters, Lulu and Yasmin, and the daughter of two others, Noura, her mother, and also her caretaker, her nanny, Maria, from India. So these four women help shape Sara, the protagonist. Now, Sara is a philosophy professor at Kuwait University who, in 2013, is accused of blasphemy under a new law that designates it a capital crime. And so as Sara awaits trial, she looks back, reckoning with her own history and some of the reasons for why she has remained kind of stuck in place for the last 11 years. And through that process, she kind of collects the stories of these four women and also her great-grandmothers, in fact, as well, who shaped her and kind of traces their geographical movements and migrations and also the history of her own country. And so through understanding their stories, she comes to understand herself. And then I won't spoil it with what happens at the end, the day of the trial, which is kind of where it ends.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So the sort of classic question is, when did you start thinking about the premise of this, of the story? How far before 2013 did the sort of idea start percolating?
Yeah, that's so when I completed my collection of short stories, The Hidden Light of Objects, I had a real sense that I wanted to write something very different. So with the short story, you know, the form itself is kind of minimal, it's sparse, it's short, obviously. And I loved working in the short story form. But I knew I wanted to write the next project would be something kind of very different, expansive, teeming. I had a sense I wanted it to be a multi-generational story. I knew that I wanted it to focus on women's stories in this part of the world. So I had all of that. And I already, for me, Lulua and Yasmin were coming to life. So the first story I started writing was Lulua's and then Yasmin's. And in fact, I was writing them as they end up in the novel itself. So back and forth between Lulua, Yasmin. And I was maybe into about, let's say, around three chapters for each of them. So maybe six chapters in total in 2013 when this law passed in Kuwait. So in 2012, a very conservative parliament was elected. So it's called the National Assembly, and a very conservative parliament was voted in. And there was a blasphemy law already. Either that parliament put a blasphemy law on the books, or they were going to amend the blasphemy law. I believe it was an amendment to the blasphemy law. And the blasphemy law that was on the books in Kuwait was, you know, don't say anything that is against God or against the prophet. And it's all very vague, and it wasn't really, not a big issue. But this parliament knew that it wanted to intensify that law and, in fact, make it a capital crime. In Kuwait in general, the judiciary is not very keen on capital punishment. There haven't been lots of capital punishments, it isn't done much in Kuwait at all. So this was really a shock. And in 2013, they passed this law, which was incredibly shocking to many of us, myself included. And it was rather vague. I sort of immediately started thinking about, as a professor teaching at Kuwait University, could the things I teach be seen as blasphemous? And absolutely they could be. I immediately started thinking about, you know, activists and the, you know, newspapers, what was going to happen with this incredible law that had just passed. And I felt devastated. I think I, you know, collapsed on the couch that day, and I really just didn't know what to do with myself. And I think it was the very next day where it just hit me that I started imagining what would it be like for a professor at Kuwait University accused of blasphemy under this new law. Selfishly thinking about myself, I guess, but also just trying to figure out what it might mean. And that's when I came up with the first Sada chapter. And it hit me instantly that this would be the granddaughter of these two women that I was already writing about. And that was really the beginning of the process.
Yeah. So for people who don't know, capital punishment is death, is a death penalty.
Oh, yes. Yeah, absolutely. Capital punishment is the death penalty, death by hanging, if I'm not mistaken, even today. So it's incredibly serious and frightening because especially because it was incredibly vague. Who got to decide if something was going to be construed as blasphemous? If you teach something, you know, if you teach Nietzsche, which is what happens to Sara as a philosophy professor, she teaches Nietzsche. And, you know, if you say, what is it that's going to be taken as blasphemous? Who gets to decide? Who makes the decisions? All of that was unclear. And so that the vagueness of this law made it incredibly scary. And it felt like, again, it made Kuwait feel like it was moving in this increasingly conservative direction. And it was, so again, this is going to be a spoiler, but at the Emir, and this is in the author's note at the back of the novel, the Emir, by Emiri decree, it was the ministers, you know, the cabinet of ministers. It wasn't by Emiri decree, I'm sorry. It was the cabinet of ministers through the Emir's wishes. Overturned the law. They didn't allow the law to go. But it took a while. It did, you know, so we lived with this law for a little bit of time. And then it was very quickly overturned. So, and that hasn't come back. But you know, the thing is, once something like that passes, it changes everything. Because you feel like if it happened once, it can certainly happen again. And it just confirms all the sort of negative sense, the negative stereotypes too that you have of the region, which is really unfortunate, you know, that such a thing had to happen.
Yeah, you know, it's, in a way, it feels like a betrayal, right?
It really does. It feels like an incredibly betrayal of all the work that people do, of also, like, you know, all the kinds of intellectual, but also sort of in, you know, the journalists, the activists, but just even people in general, this idea that you have to control what people are saying or thinking about their religion, or, you know, that, or that a religion is so incredibly fragile that if you say something against it, as if it will just, you know, dissolve into nothing. Of course, that isn't true at all. So yes, it did feel like a betrayal on many, many levels, I think.
Yeah. And in a way, I feel like I may as well jump to this now. You know, part of what you're talking about, I feel like, is a meditation on this idea that, you know, no one really belongs anywhere, maybe. You know, it's almost like you're exploring that idea. It might just be true that no one belongs anywhere, and it's almost certainly true that some people don't belong anywhere. And
No,
does that sound right to you?
That sounds absolutely correct to me, because there are a couple of things. So the second thing you said is that, you know, it's really unfortunate that in many states there are people who are desperate to belong. So in Kuwait, we have the situation of the Bedouin, the stateless, and there's absolutely no reason why these people who have been here for generations, children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, people who have been incredibly loyal to the country in so many ways, who have worked in the country, who have helped establish the country, a history that goes back, a population that's not in, it's not so big. We're not talking about massive numbers. And it's an inhumane situation that can be so easily resolved is just not being resolved. And such people are desperate to belong to a place. Refugees are in the same precarious position. So I don't want to make it seem, you know, romantic and kind of romanticizing this idea of not belonging, knowing how many people suffer in a situation of not belonging. At the same time, I think we also these days seem to be so bent on an idea of clinging to an identity, claiming whatever identity that might be, sometimes for important political reasons, sometimes for feeling, again, a desire to belong and to kind of lay claim to who I am, in what place, and so on. And that could be outside your home. Maybe you've immigrated, and so you really want to cling to a sense of identity. But I think also perhaps there's too much identity. We you know, and these things too can lead to terrible things like war. When we cling so desperately to whatever identity that might be, religious or nationalist or, you know, whatever, and it leads to divisions. And I find value in not belonging. I think there's something, and I think the novel does explore this idea that not belonging also gives us a certain advantage, a certain flexibility and an openness towards difference, to be able to accept and understand or try to put yourself in the position of others who are different than yourself. When you are not so bent on belonging, I think it opens up a kind of world of possibility. And I think fiction is that world too, right? I mean, fiction is the place that you get to experiment with not belonging because you're reading about somebody completely different than yourself. And so I think for me, all these ideas blend together. And I do think that there is some kind of value in thinking about not belonging.
Yeah. You know, it's almost like the character is, you know, is digesting the idea that the state might be betraying her, right? But the right. as she dives into her own family tree, it becomes more obvious that maybe she's betraying her own history, and that her sort of connection, deep connection to the state, and oh, this is where I belong, this is where I'm from, maybe actually betrays the truth about how fluid everything is.
I think for Sara, she felt, so by the time she's accused of blasphemy in 2013, she's been back in Kuwait for 11 years. And what brings her back is the death of her mother. And, you know, she makes the decision to stay. And I think she isn't quite sure why she's come back. She doesn't have to come back. You know, her mother, her mother Noura had really prepared her and her brother Karim to make their way out into the world. She gave them the best possible education. She gave them every opportunity, because Noura herself had dreams that were unfulfilled in Kuwait because of the way, you know, women weren't allowed to participate in politics at the time that Noura was of age and wanted to. And so Noura had dreams of being in the United States, working in Middle East policy in the U.S. She couldn't do that. She had to come back. So she wanted to, for her kids to have every chance, every opportunity. But when Sara, you know, goes to an American school in Kuwait, so she's kind of already half in, half out, because of language, because of education, because of her mother, and then, of course, her own cosmopolitan history, which she doesn't really know that much about to begin with. When she comes back to Kuwait in 11 years before 20, so around 2002, 2001, 2002, after 9/11, she comes for reasons that she doesn't fully understand. She's not sure that she's coming back to kind of reclaim belonging. I don't think it's that simple. But she is. She has this almost instinct that coming back is imperative, that she has to do it, even before it is almost too late, because everybody she loves is almost gone. There are very few people left. But when she comes back, she manages to collect the stories of one of her grandmothers who's left, Yasmin, who holds many of the stories of the other women, and Maria, her beloved Aya, or nanny, who helps to raise her. She also holds many of these lost stories that Sara was not privy to. If Sara had not come back, all those stories would have been lost to oblivion. So in a way, her coming back is about instinctually not knowing why, but coming back, and she finds this repository of stories waiting for her. The other thing she realizes, though, in trying to find her way into a Kuwait that she grew up in, was the sense that Kuwait is no longer there. It's gone. You know, that she's been away for so long. She comes back. Everything has changed. This is after the invasion. It's after 9/11. So much has changed. Even though when she was a kid, all she wanted was to go to the States and be in the States, right? Her dream was to do that. But once she was there, she sort of doesn't quite fit there either. But in coming back, looking for whatever it was that she thought might be there was no longer. And so in letting Kuwait go, in a way, Sara doesn't let Kuwait go. Kuwait lets Sara go. I think that would be the more appropriate or correct or a correct way to see it, I think.
What has the response been from, you know, your friends and colleagues who, you know, this is not an original story. This resonates with me tremendously. What has the sort of the response been from people who might feel sort of like this is almost autobiographical for them as well?
It's been so incredibly fulfilling to hear some of the feedback, because, you know, when you're writing and working on a project for so long and you're so immersed in it, and you don't necessarily, I try not to think too much about audience in that sense, like a reception. or what it's going to, what people are going to read, how they're going to receive it. But, you know, I've had people say to me, someone my age, somebody I went to school with said, you know, how did you get inside my mind? Yeah. How did you know that these were, you know, how did you get? And I mean, to me, what a compliment. That was like, wow, you know, that's amazing for me to be able to hear that. And it is so, so lovely to know that it resonates. And I have been hearing that both from Kuwaitis and non-Kuwaiti residents and longtime residents in Kuwait who have said things like, you know, an unlasting home is exactly how we feel that Kuwait is to us because it's so much their home. And yet it is always, they know almost from the get-go that it's a home that's always going to be unlasting for them because they won't be allowed to stay at the end of their work, their period of working, even after 60 years, let's say. So I think it has resonated with a lot of people. I've had friends from outside of Kuwait too that grew up here that says that it, you know, that tell me that it captured something about the life that they remember in the 80s and the 70s. And so that's really, it's satisfying to hear that and it makes me really happy.
Yeah. It's definitely, there is a universality to it, a sort of a sad universality.
Yeah.
I want to talk about, you know, there is universality about that, but what is sort of unique about the Kuwait story? Because Kuwait is in this very interesting place. And the last, you know, the last 40 years, more than that, 50 years of the Kuwaiti story, really from, you know, the 60s onwards, is unique. Especially when you think about the GCC, it's definitely unique, but even the region at large. Can you help sort of put some meat on those bones to help explain what is unique about the Kuwaiti experience and sort of Kuwait and its borders?
That is a really dense question to unpack, and I'll try. So I think in many ways, I mean, we could start very early on. Kuwait, just its position, the way that it's positioned in the Gulf, meant that it was outward looking, you know, and that's as a result of trade, as a result of the things that it was doing in order to survive and to keep itself. And then Kuwait maintained a kind of autonomy for itself between the Ottomans, after the Ottomans, the British, with pressure from Saudi Arabia trying to take it over the years. Through all of that, Kuwait managed to maintain a degree of autonomy. Pressure from Iraq, really, when it proclaimed its independence in the 60s, the immediate pressure was from Iraq. So through it all, Kuwait had a very strong sense of itself, small but present and quite individual in its sense of its identity. You know, even during the 1920s, during the standoff with the Ikhwan and Ibn Saud and all of that, after it lost, thanks to the British, 2/3 of its land to Saudi Arabia, and even after all of that, after the Battle of Jahra, one of the things that Saudi, you know, the Ikhwan said to Kuwait is, you have to fulfill these five things. You have to kick out all the Shia from Kuwait. This is in the 20s. You have to declare that the Turks are heretics. You have to ban smoking, prostitution, and al-munkar, like any prohibited behavior. So apparently this was going on in Kuwait because it was a raucous port town, you know, and so there were things that the Ikhwan didn't like. And then to demolish the American Missionary Hospital, and I can't remember what the other one was. To adopt the doctrine of the Ikhwan. And so I think one of the British who were there wrote back, not one of these, prohibitions or whatever that the Ikhwan wanted was taken up by the Kuwaitis. So none of that happened. None of them have been done. So, you know, there is this kind of stubborn sense of itself, small as it is, you know, that has always existed and continues to exist. Another interesting element just from that past is that, you know, for, 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 for a place which relied on trade, and the men were sailors, really wonderful sailors, that went out and were out for 9 months or more, women had a really prominent role then in society, in running things, in controlling things, dealing with the money, dealing with the everyday, dealing even with, you know, obviously shopping and going out and doing things, running the show. And so that has made, and I think we continue to feel that it made women, Kuwaiti women, quite strong, with a strong voice and a strong presence.
It is,
and
you does felt feel that. Like a matriarchy, if there's a matriarchy in the region.
Yes, it does. It did. And I really think that you can trace that back to those hundreds of years or however many years of trade and women being in charge of things. And so when you move then into the 20th century, the establishment of the state, you know, again, women were fighting for rights from the get-go, and you did see that they had a lot of, they really did enjoy a lot of privileges and well, rights, I should say, that other women in the region didn't until much, much later. So dressing as they pleased, driving, as we see the character Noura in the novel, you know, that kind of life, traveling in the 60s, traveling to Beirut. So Beirut was like Kuwait's sister city, right? They would to go and to kind of live that golden life that was experienced in both places is something that is also true of Kuwait's history. I think another element, what makes it unique in the region, is that it was a kind of a crossroads in the sense that from the 1940s, you had a lot of, and we'll talk about this later, but the Palestinian population that came into Kuwait from the 1940s, and then again in the 60s, and again in the 70s, and was a well-established, extremely important population, a people in Kuwait helping to develop the nation state, and well-integrated and part of the community. And then, you know, Kuwait was extremely open to people from the outside coming in, helping to build the nation state. And it was when I was growing up, but even before that, so the 1950s, 60s, into the 70s and 80s, really, truly, and I don't use this word lightly, a cosmopolitan place, a mix of people. There was a sense that Kuwaitis were open, again, from that old port town sensibility, open to the world, open to other people's knowledge and expertise, accepting it, exchanging. And there was a kind of generosity of spirit, I think, that existed for a long period of time. So that, I think, gives a little bit of sense of how unique Kuwait is. I think it's geographical. It has to do with, you know, the people themselves and their experience based on that geography, their own particular history. And I think that is kind of what has made Kuwait an interesting and unique place.
In growing up, or sort of, let me think about the 90s and the 2000s. You know, I'm on the phone from Beirut. The cloud of the 1975 Civil War, it's hard not to notice it, right, in the sky. It's always there. You know, even at this point, you know, 50 years later almost, 2 years, it's going to be 50 years. It's crazy. It's still there. It's part of our, our psyche. It's part of our story. It's really, really hard not to think of it. How much is the Iraq invasion and the sort of Gulf War still part of collective memory in Kuwait? And how much of it is part of the story that you're trying to tell?
So I think that it is part of the psyche, but not in the same way that the civil war in Lebanon is. I think that for a certain generation, my generation and those older than me, it's very, very much a part of their psyche. And there's a before the war and an after the war. But I think for the younger generation, there was a concerted effort to kind of erase the memory of what happened, not to really interrogate the details of how this situation came to pass. There's almost a kind of turning the trauma or turning that event into a kind of monument, rather than really dissecting the elements of it and working through them as you would work through a trauma, let's say. So you can go to a museum and look at certain things and you learn a certain lesson. Okay, so this happened to Kuwait and so on. But even right after the invasion, the aim was to kind of get it over with as soon as possible. Let's rebuild. So for the first few years, there was this effort to just let's rebuild everything from scratch. Let's erase what happened. And we want to get over it. And I think a lot of people, while they talked about what happened, it wasn't that they rehearsed what happened and the experience, which was so intense for these 9 months. I do think after there was this sense that, okay, now it's over. Now we need to rebuild and then forget. I think there is a kind of effort of there was an experience. I call it a kind of amnesia. There was a kind of amnesia, a double amnesia. There are two kinds of amnesia that I identify. One is the amnesia of the pre-invasion Kuwait. So the kind of cosmopolitan Kuwait that I was talking about, which I think in my collection of short stories, I deal with that loss and that experience of amnesia. And the second is the experience of the invasion, which again, is there, people remember. It's commemorated, but it's a kind of official commemoration rather than, I think, a real understanding of the trauma and the elements that built up to the event itself. I also think it changed Kuwait, of course, as you can imagine. And so that openness that I spoke about earlier became much more closed. So this is when things really, really changed. I think people's psychologies changed. Abdirida Esiri, who's a sociologist at Kuwait University, describes it as a siege mentality. We went from being outward looking to closed. It became much more, exactly that, a siege mentality, because people start, we felt defensive, people felt, we were attacked, we were betrayed, all of this. And so we need to rely on ourselves or we need to rely on others. Kuwait was very much almost non-aligned before the invasion. They were very much about the region. They were very Arab focused and, wanting to kind of create peace in the region as much as possible. They were always involved in those kinds of efforts rather than sort of aligning themselves with the U.S. or anyone. I mean, we didn't have, just this is a basic thing, but we didn't have McDonald's and Coca-Cola before the invasion. I mean, those symbols of American consumerism that are emblematic, we did not have. We did not grow up with that. So after that, it changed completely, of course. And so I think that is one of the, that's how the invasion is kind of, is how, that's how I see it. I think it's so key.
Yeah, because that trauma is sort of like unroots you,
Yes,
it does. As a society. And so it's almost like, okay, let's not replant the roots. Let's just put the plant on top of the soil and put a couple of things and just sit it upright.
Absolutely. And also then we make, I remember this story when after the invasion, I was 20 when we came back. And my cohort, my friends, we were super excited. We're going to change things because, of course, before the invasion happened, things in Kuwait weren't great. There had been a suspension of the National Assembly from 1986. And the reason for that was given was that, because the Iraq-Iran war, there's a lot of tension. Kuwait had suffered because it sided with Iraq during that war. There had been attacks in Kuwait, some of which I get into in the novel. And so things were unstable. And certainly there was pressure in terms of freedom of speech. Newspapers were shut down. There, even the douanias, which were private, meeting the douania culture in Kuwait, where people get together and they meet the men primarily in their homes and so on. That's sacred in Kuwait, but even the douanias were attacked and so on. So there were a lot of things that were going on that needed to really be reckoned with after the invasion. While the parliament was reinstituted after the invasion, as promised by the emir, many of the other issues that had been brewing for maybe a decade, from 1979, let's say, up until the invasion, hadn't really, I think, been dealt with sufficiently. And I think we're still kind of dealing with those issues. So as you said, just plopping the tree back on without kind of untangling those roots, I thought when I came back and my generation, I mean, my group of friends were like, everything's going to change. It's going to be different. We're going to, we're going to make sure that things are different, done differently this time. And I remember there was this old British professor who was at Kuwait University at the time. And he's like, nothing's going to change. Everything's going to be the same. You know, you're going to be exactly the same. And I'm like, oh, what do you know? You know, you're just old. but he was right. He was not wrong, I have to say. Yeah.
So what advice would you give yourself? You know, younger May coming back ambitiously.
Wow. Oh.
Would you have said, listen, it's okay. You don't belong to Kuwait. Go explore yourself somewhere else. Plant your roots somewhere else.
Mikey, that's such a tough question. That is such a tough question. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what I would say because I can't regret the trajectory of my life. You know, I can't, part of me does, but if you do that, you know, all of those experiences, all the disappointments, and there have been many, 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 have brought me to where I am today, able to write this book, you know, with this rich, this layered history of the place that I'm from and the other places that I've been lucky enough to be a part of have shaped me. So if I had gone somewhere else at 19, at 20, and established myself, let's say in the US or somewhere else, I don't think I would have been able to write this book, which is and it matters to me that I wrote this book or my collection of short stories, you know, that this is, in a sense, a kind of love letter, I think, to a Kuwait of the imagination. It's not a Kuwait that necessarily exists. Maybe it never existed. Maybe it was always my engagement with Kuwait that made these stories possible. The only thing that sometimes makes me feel that's not true is when it connects with other readers, as I kind of said, when they're like, yes, we remember this Kuwait. And in a way, the collection of short stories that I wrote was, it was for me to remind myself that this existed because the amnesia around me made it seem like it didn't. And then when a few readers, you know, told me, yes, you know, we remember you brought this to life for us, that was really satisfying, you know, to kind of say, okay, well, at least it exists here in fiction. So no, I guess I would tell myself, I guess I would just tell myself to do it, whatever it was, that don't lose that idealism, go with it. And then, you know, it'll be tempered soon enough.
I forgot. I apologize to whoever this was, but there was somebody else on a previous episode. I remember somebody said, I'm not optimistic, but I am hopeful. And I have clung to that because I think about that all the time, especially in Lebanon. It's like, I can't be optimistic about what's happening. It's impossible. I mean, I would be betraying so much of what I know.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I can simultaneously be hopeful and lack a sense of optimism.
So you know what? I will crush your the thing that you've been clinging to, because I will say I don't like to cling too much to hope, because I feel like hope, you're almost always setting yourself up for disappointment with hope, and it's a kind of idealism. Hope is a kind of ideal. We aspire to. It gives us a sense, you know, that we can aspire to this thing, and we have this hope for something to actualize. Whereas I feel like, get rid of the hope and do the thing, whatever that is. You know, so if you feel like there's this thing that you need to do, forget the hope. It's the world that you want to unfold. Do whatever little thing you can do to make that happen. And that's the thing that's going to happen in your short time, the short time that you have, you know, whatever expertise that you have, whatever thing that it is that you want to contribute and do, just do it without hope. And then something will unfold. That's the good news, right? Something will unfold. It may be better, it may be worse, but it will be something and it will go on. And your contribution, I think, will matter. It will matter, maybe in the tiniest way, but it will make a difference if you're doing it without hope. You go on anyway, as Beckett would say. You just go on anyway.
Yeah. I want to talk about fiction. In a region where the powers that be control education, And oftentimes the media is controlled by their state media. Even if they're not state media, they're state media. It almost seems like fiction is the only refuge for us to tell our stories. Loosely, not autobiographical as they may seem. Do you feel like there's any other way to erase the double amnesia that you're talking about? The amnesia of, let's not talk about moments of the past that may refute or change our story of self and what we think our state morals are and ethics. And also, let's erase the very painful, messy moments of dispute and war and conflict. Do you think fiction is the only way to do that?
I believe in the powers of fiction, but I don't think it's the only way to do that. So, the good news is that you can do whatever work you feel like you need to do in terms of if you are a historian and you want to unpack an unwritten or undiscussed history, and you don't have to publish it in the Middle East. I mean, if you feel like, or you don't have to publish it in your own country, which is sad, but everyone will have access to it. It's going to be very difficult for, in some ways, the governments that may want to control the narrative or whatever it is that people want to explain or express or share, they're going to have a very hard time putting a cap on that these days, wherever you might reside. So I think that there are other forms that can express this amnesia, the unwritten histories, the stories that have been denied, not given a voice. I think that there are many avenues in which those can be expressed, which is really great for us to know that that's possible. However, fiction, as you're pointing at, and I couldn't agree with you more, is such a creative and specific and singular form through which to kind of express that complexity, maybe without the burden of having to document everything, because it's personal, maybe built on autobiographical elements or memoir, some historical truths, but without letting go the power of what fiction can do, which is to shape that history, I think. And I think also people like to read fiction in a way that they might not want to read academic books or essays or whatever else. And that to be absorbed in that fiction, to hear that story that you can relate to, as we said, you know, that these stories, these voices that people relate to when they read, that makes them feel seen in a way, that makes them feel heard and remembered, right? So, or maybe then for the first time being introduced, like some of my students, when I share some of the experiences I had growing up, or share a glimpse of what Kuwait's history was before they were born, before maybe some of their parents were even born. They're able again to connect with something that they weren't able to see before. So I think that fiction does have a really particular power, but I think luckily there are other forms that can do the same kind of thing.
Very cool. Let's talk a little bit. You alluded to it earlier. I told you before we started the call that I really wanted to talk about one of your essays or papers that you had published sort of academically. It caught my eye. You had published a few essays and chapters about the relationship between Palestine and Kuwait and the Palestinians in Kuwait. And there was this one piece about Ghassan Kanafani where that explores sort of the image and idea of Kuwait in his work. Can you tell us a little bit about what that relationship is and sort of the why it's special, why it's worth examining?
Sure. I mean, I guess I can start at the beginning. Before I wrote this essay, I wrote another essay called "The People Are Missing: Palestinians in Kuwait," and the work of Dr. Shafiq Ghabra, who was an incredible Palestinian Kuwaiti scholar who's documented the history of Palestinians in Kuwait. He was a political scientist, and he wrote a number of essays about the breakdown of that relationship after the invasion. So maybe just to fill you in a little bit on that, the Palestinians in Kuwait again, as I said before, it had been a really important relationship between the two communities. And the Palestinians came to Kuwait at a time when Kuwaitis really needed this extremely educated, very professional, very experienced population. And they helped to establish every element of the modern nation state in Kuwait, from building the electricity and running it, and the water, to the army, to the passport system, to banks, to the most important key aspect, which was education. Palestinians played an extremely important role in the education of the education system in Kuwait, and really being teachers and so on. So you can imagine this important population, and ideologically as well, Kuwaitis were very supportive of the Palestinians and the Palestinian cause. All of that, this coexistence that carried all the way through to the point of the invasion. With the invasion, you know, we had the PLO supporting Saddam Hussein, and this led to an incredible backlash against the community of Palestinians within Kuwait. And so for the Palestinians, there was a kind of second trauma, not only the trauma of the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait, but then the second trauma of not being permitted to come back to Kuwait if they left, or being pushed out of the country. So a population of approximately 380,000 was reduced down to about 70,000 after the invasion. For me, who grew up with this community, was educated by this community, had so many friends who are part of this community, it was a trauma. This was a real loss. For the country, it was a major loss, because it meant, really, for me, it was the start of the demise of the system of education. And where we are today in so many ways is a result of the system, the decline or the absolute failure of our public system of education. And that coincides with the loss of the Palestinian population. So all of this was all in my head, you know, so I was really lamenting the loss of this population, and I really felt there was a misunderstanding and a misrepresentation of the Palestinians who were part of the Kuwaiti community. This was not the PLO. These were not people who were against Kuwait. These were people who helped during the invasion, the Kuwaiti population, in so many ways. And so as I was trying to kind of really come to terms with what it meant to lose this community, what was Kuwait going to lose? It was losing a lot. And I was trying to reconcile and trying to figure out, and also trying to get us as a population to understand what we had done. We had just suffered an invasion, which was awful, and it was morally wrong. But then what we did was in turn also morally wrong to this population. It was wrong, and we were going to suffer for it. Now, Ghassan Kanafani, who is one of my favorite authors, and I respect him so much in so many ways on so many levels, and his book, Men in the Sun, was, you know, when I first read that book, and I saw how, you know, there was Kuwait. Kuwait was this kind of figured as this promised land for this group of, you know, people that were these three men who were really in the worst possible situation and aiming to come to this promised land of Kuwait. I'd never seen Kuwait as a promised land, you know, so to envision it this way, you know, to see, you know.
This El Dorado, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly, the place of gold, exactly, that's how it's figured, you know. So, and then I started reading more of Kanafani's work, and then Kuwait appears again and again as this sort of place of promise. And of course, Kanafani himself had landed in Kuwait, had been in Kuwait for the early part of his years. He did not stay. He moved, right? He moved to Beirut. But what Kanafani could see was that Kuwait was not a promised land. Not because of anything that was wrong with Kuwait, but because, you know, he really wanted the Palestinians to not, you know, necessarily cling or rely or feel that they had to rely on anybody else's promises in order to fulfill their objective and their goals. And he was right. You know, he was absolutely right about that. And that was something for me, it was interesting to kind of, trace how he investigated, how he, as a clinician, really unpacked what Kuwait was going to mean to the Palestinians. And, you know, so many decades later, that's exactly what it turned out to be.
Yeah, very, very powerful. This, anyone who's interested in checking this out, this essay, along with the other one that May mentioned, is on May's website. Okay, let's do the quick Q&A and then we're going to wrap up.
Okay.
Okay, first, what are you reading these days?
I am reading Rajesh Hada's We Could Have Been Friends, My Father and I. I just started it a few days ago. It's absolutely beautiful. I love how Raja writes. And, you know, this telling this parallel story between about his father and the story of Palestine, you know, this double kind of reckoning with the lost father and the stolen homeland is really so compelling and so powerful. I just think I'm really enjoying it.
Cool.
It's wonderful.
Raja, if you're listening, you should be getting an email pretty soon. We want you on the series.
Yes, absolutely. He should be. Yeah.
Okay, cool. Next one. Who would you love to shadow for a day, past or present?
So I thought about this again. I thought about Kafka to Kanafani, my favorite writers. Would I want to shadow them? And I think no, because we have these intimate relationships with their writing. I don't want to know what they're really.
Don't meet your heroes.
I don't want to meet my heroes. But if I had to, I thought I could go far enough back to meet Cervantes. I thought, you know, the inventor of the modern European novel. And he just, you know, he had this sort of very difficult life, which I think is what made him kind of create this character who was a reader going out into the world on these adventures, into this uncertain world and the kind of disappointments that unfold. I thought he would be an interesting one that I would really love to kind of shadow.
Cool. What do people most misunderstand about your work?
I think that it is probably that they think it is automatically autobiographical. So there is always the one of the first questions is it your life? Are you Sara? Or even with the short stories. And I can understand that, you know, but I think what it stops you from doing when you connect the work, always a work of fiction, back to the author's life or to the author, you are really kind of limiting what fiction can do. And what it can do is allow you to connect, allow you to put yourself in someone else's shoes. And so I think that that would be the thing I get the most.
Yeah. Do you know Norm Macdonald? Do you know that comedian Norm Macdonald?
The comedian? Yeah, of course. I love him.
So he wrote a book and... I forget the main title, but the subtitle is a memoir.
Okay.
But it's the main character's name is Norm Macdonald, and all the characters' names in the memoir are people that you imagine, but none of it is true.
Fantastic.
100% of it is completely made up stories. And in an interview, somebody was asking him, they're like, "So wait, is this nonfiction or is this fiction?" And then in every interview, I've seen him talk about it. He says it's fiction, but it's all true.
Yeah,
and that's essentially what you're saying, right? You're
it is.
Saying,
there's a special truth to fiction that yeah. has nothing to do with the life of the author. You know,
yeah.
So and I mean, memoirs are fine, but I really love fiction, and I find fiction to be, as you said, in a way, more true almost than the memoir. You know, so yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly.
It's a very funny read. It's a novel. It's not a memoir. He just is like making the point on its head.
Yeah. Sounds clever.
Okay. Outside of your profession, whose work inspires you?
So always the work of philosophers. For me, you know, thinkers like from Nietzsche to Bergson to Spinoza, Deleuze, Walter Benjamin, and many, many others. I always turn to their work for inspiration. They've been important to my academic writing and thinking, but I think even beyond that, they've shaped who I am as a person, these philosophical writings. So I always go back to them for solace, for understanding, for inspiration. Yeah.
Do you feel like your students at Kuwait University connect with the same work that you connect with in the same way?
No. No, I think that they can connect. When I try to convey my enthusiasm over whatever it is that I'm teaching, they certainly pick up on that and are very open to everything. I mean, they really are. They are excited to learn and to learn about things. But I think that, you know, I think this is true of everyone. Everyone has their own constellation of writers, artists, philosophers, whatever it is, maybe scientists, whatever who you are, who you become, is shaped by, I like to think of it as a kind of constellation. And those enthusiasms you're going to carry with you always. And so they will have their own constellation, I think. And it's not going to be the same as mine. And I'm also older than them, so it's going to be really different.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay, so if anyone's interested in connecting with May, you can find her on social media at May Al-Naqib. That's M-A-I-L-A-N-A-K-I-B. I think I got that right. Is that right?
It's MAIALNAKIB.com.
My dyslexia gets me every time. May, thank you so much. It was really, really a pleasure to have you on the series. And for anyone looking to get the book, you can find it everywhere. May, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much. This was an absolute pleasure.
Hey, I hope you enjoyed that episode. If you'd like to watch the full uncut version, go to youtube.com/afikra. There you can see the full video versions of these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about what we do, go to afikra.com, where you can learn about our Zoom events, our live events in 30 different chapters around the world, our social media presence, and our podcasts and YouTube stuff. You should know that everything we do is all towards a mission of converting passive interest in the histories and cultures of the Arab world into an active intellectual curiosity. By listening to this, you're a part of that movement, so thank you for being here. If you'd like to support our work, go to afikra.com/support and join the hundreds of people around the world who make this work possible. Thanks.